discuss misuse of information technology, which was quite interesting. That was a bit long. So the
did you try clenching your anus to defeat the polygraph? Do you know that thing?
I use no countermeasures whatsoever.
No! What an opportunity squandered!
However, they did try some nonsense on me whether they claimed that, you know, they didn't believe my statements about drug usage, and then I wouldn't answer the control questions. And so that was the countermeasure that I employed, was that, you know, I refused to answer the control questions. I knew what they were. I thought at the end of the day, there's no way I'm going to get a security clearance, certainly not TSSCI. But I did, shockingly, in any event. The point I wanted to make, though, about it is, you know, with the character that you mentioned that was over at West Point, and what I had in my mind at the time, too, was that sometimes there is an argument to be made that you can do more good from within than from without. If you had taken that DRM evangelist role with Microsoft, perhaps you might have had a chance to change their mind. I mean, look, I think it's a fat chance, of course. But, you know, ultimately, I decided not to go back into the government for a number of different reasons. You know, pay was one of them. But I think this is like a running theme, you know, within the book as well. And it sort of starts out there, and it's almost like carbon offsetting, right, where you're doing some harm, and so you need to go and help activists, you know, on the side. But then there's this great line that I remember, and it stuck with me. And it was something about, I don't want to give too much of the book away, but it was something about when a hobby becomes a moral imperative. And I feel like that almost describes the hacker community itself, right? Wherever you find yourself, you may be doing good, you may be doing bad, but at the end of the day, that hobby of yours has become who you are as a hacker. And it is your moral imperative to do some good, whether it's from within or from without.
Corey, I'll let you address that in a second, but legally I have to say this is WBAI New York, and you are listening to an extended edition of Off the Hook. We're going to be on until 8:30, at which time Gloria J. Brown Marshall comes on with a special pre-vice presidential debate edition of Law of the Land. So stay tuned for that, and stay tuned after that for the actual vice presidential debate, where you will hear live over FM radio Mike Pence getting his ass kicked. I'm looking forward to that.
Although you should tune in, because they're going to use those that like spectrum of lasers to spot all the aerosol droplets moving from Joe Biden to Kamala Harris's side of the screen and back again. It's going to be awesome.
You said Joe Biden. You meant Mike Pence.
I meant Mike Pence.
Freudian slip. Now, yes, Corey, can I ask you that little trick about defeating the polygraph? Did you get that from the Americans? I saw that recently.
No, I got it from the polygraph.org guy, or defeatpolygraph.org. I forget what it's called. It's that there is a guy.
Yeah, he gave a talk at Hope. He gave a talk at Hope,
yeah,
I believe. Yeah.
He's the 2600 DCSS guy of polygraphs who, you know, is like, God damn it, I'm going to publish how to defeat this thing that it's illegal to publish information about how to defeat,
uh-huh,
and become a cause celeb, which, you know, he has and does and is very committed to. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean no disrespect when I say that the people who get into this kind of trouble tend to be cranks,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
Like you and me, right? That, like, the kind of person who's like, God damn it, my digest-sized magazine needs to explain how to crack DVDs, and I'm willing to, like, risk felony prosecution for it. That is not the activity of a normal person who goes along to get along. And a lot of the times when we see people who do these extraordinary things, they are a little off, you know, present company included.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And sometimes we focus on that, and I want to – and maybe this is getting back to Snowden. Sometimes we focus on that. We're like, look at this weirdo, right, as opposed to look at this revelation. We're like, look at this weirdo who's being a weird guy, not look at the information he's brought us about how the polygraph is a house of cards, how we, you know, ground our national security in junk science and witchcraft and ruin people's lives with it. And, you know, one of the things about Snowden that was amazing – and that makes me have so much respect for him, is he kept himself out of the story. That he actually – of all the whistleblowers and cranks and, you know, glorious freaks who've come out and made the world the as good as it can be under the circumstances, he is the one that seemed to understand best that the story needed to be about the leaks and not about the leaker.
Yes.
And he took such pains to stay out of the public eye. And when he came in, he was at such pains to like reveal the parts of himself that he knew were compromising and say, look, this is me. It is who I am. I am imperfect. Let's talk about the leaks and to bring it back to the leaks. And if you read Permanent Record, if you read his memoir, he is really clear that this was a deliberate strategy. And I remember when the leaks happened, you know, sitting around with other EFF folks and other people who cared about this stuff, not knowing who Snowden was yet, and just going, oh, please, please don't let him be an a-hole. Like, please, you know, just because, not because it matters, but because that'll make this story about him. And these leaks are so important. And, you know, not only was he not an a-hole, but he, it wouldn't have mattered if he was, because he was smart enough to stay out of the story, make the story about the leaks and not him.
One other parallel story is Chris Wiley's book about working for Internet Research Agency. I find some parallels there as well. But Snowden lays out so perfectly the contractor element of work for entities like the CIA and the government. And one point I would put forth, kind of in response to what Alex was saying, is that this stuff has grown when you start getting into ad networks and private entities trading in people's information and so on. It's not necessarily something you're duty-bound to do. It's more about, will I be employed or not? And the kinds of sacrifices people are sort of having to make to go for their dream of being involved in X or Y industry, then realizing halfway down, oh my gosh, I'm building something awful. And I think another thing that leaps out in this audiobook is the compartmentalization, because that's how the workers are treated by these entities, whether it's government or a private company. So anyway, I don't know if there's a question there, but I've really felt like, what is this doing to us? That would be my question. Like, I know so many of these people that really don't have a lot of opportunities. They get clearances, they get involved in private or government entities at a certain point. But I felt like, is this further dividing us? Is just more heterogeneous fodder for our hacker community? Or are we able to get past this? Like, is this something we're getting away from, or is it something we're only beginning to see as people have really fewer and fewer careers, or they're not really inspired enough to go out on their own and do, like, run a magazine or do something on their own?
Right. Well, you're definitely getting into an area that I'm really concerned about. I just want to go back quickly and say Wiley worked for Cambridge Analytica, not Internet Research Agency.
I'm sorry, yes.
Although that was a great slip. That was an awesome slip. You know, one of the things that gets people to do the wrong thing is a foreclosing on their opportunities. And one of the areas where opportunities have been thoroughly foreclosed upon is in labor markets, right? There's a great quote by the New Zealand software developer, Tom Eastman. I'm old enough to remember when the web did not consist of five giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other four. And the transformation of the web and all its related industries and so many other industries, from beer to pro wrestling to eyeglasses, into these monopolized markets, mean that you can't tell your boss, take this job and shove it, because there isn't anywhere else to go, right? When you look at, say, the entertainment industry, you know, I live here in Southern California. I live in Los Angeles County. And for more than a year, the Screenwriters Guild was on strike against all of the big talent agencies, because the four big talent agencies, they bought all their competitors, which is a thing that used to be illegal until the Reagan era. They bought all their competitors. They took a bunch of private equity money. So there's just four big games in town. And then they started structuring these deals where they would be your agent as the writer, but they would offer the studio a break if they would also bring in a director and a star who they also represented. And they would take a piece out of all of your paychecks rather than as a commission. They would just accept a lower fee for you and then take a packaging fee from the studio. So this is your agent who's agreeing that you should get less money so they can get more money. And two of the four agencies have caved. All the mid-sized agencies, which are really small, caved pretty quickly. But two of the big four agencies have caved. Two of them haven't. William Morris and CAA are still not in there. And, you know, if there's only four big agencies, why would they cave, right? Why should they? And, you know, those four big agencies, they do business with four big movie studios. And so, you know, that like, it's not like there's a lot of ways to shop around or get around them either. So when there's only a few games in town, it becomes a really big deal. And of course, you know, the big news today, apart from the presidential election and all the rest of it, is that Congress dropped a 420-page report on market concentration in the tech industry, proposing to really like break up tech giants mm-hmm. and start doing trust busting the way FDR did with Standard Oil 100 years ago, which, you know, that's exciting and wild. And it's really an acknowledgement that our labor markets have become places where you have to accept these compromises to work. And there's a term from labor economics called chickenization, and it comes from the poultry industry. And the poultry industry, they divided up America the way the Pope divided up the New World. There's only three big chicken packers. And if you're a poultry farmer, there's only one meatpacking plant, poultry processing plant, within range of you that you could get your birds to within the safe travel distance. And that company has an exclusive arrangement with you as their independent contractor. And they sell you the chicks or the eggs. They tell you what kind of coop you have to build. They tell you what sensors go in it, and they get to see the telemetry from the sensors. They tell you what to feed the birds and how often to feed them, when the lights go on, when they go off, which vet you can use, and what medicines they can get, you can give them. They experiment on you. So they do A-B splits, where one farm will have one schedule and the other farm will have another schedule. And only when you're ready to sell the birds do they tell you how much they're going to pay you for them. And because they're the only game in town, they know exactly how much they can give you so that you keep growing birds, so that you keep farming for them, but that you never get ahead and you can never get independent. And suicide rates in chicken farmers have taken off. And industry after industry, we are chickenizing workers, right? We're turning workers into independent contractors, shifting the risk off of the balance sheet of the employer and onto the balance sheet of the workers. I mean, that's just how Uber works. Uber is a chickenization outfit, wow. Right? You may have seen ProPublica did this huge thing on Arise, this big work-from-home phone center, where if you call Disney or Comcast or Airbnb or many other big blue chip companies, you think you're talking to a phone bank. You're actually talking to an independent contractor working in their living room. They have to pay for the job. They have to pay to be trained. And then if they and they only get these half-hour shifts, they're spread out through the day, so they can't do another job. They're only paid while they're talking to you. They're not allowed to hang up if you start sexually abusing them over the phone. Most of the people who work for them are women, and most of them are women of color, mostly black women. And if they get sick of this because they've gotten into debt working for you in this chickenized call center and they quit, they have to pay to quit. They have to pay an early contract termination fee. And they can be fired at any time with no notice because they're independent contractors. So chickenization forces us to do things we don't want to do. You know, the ProPublica article quoted these women who are like, I had the company I worked for, AT&T, would just listen in on my calls. And if they could hear my kids in the background, I would get docked. And if I got docked twice, they would kick me off. And the money I spent to be training as an AT&T operator, I would have to forfeit. So as we lost more and more money with me doing this job, we had to move into successively smaller homes to the point where there was nowhere my kids could be that they couldn't be heard. And so what I had to do was make my kids be totally silent so that I could do my job. It was like, it's like Anne Frank or something, wow. Right? Except it's AT&T chickenizing you over the wiretap while you're taking calls from angry people they've screwed over, right? So yeah, like, you're right, there are many labor markets in which people are corralled into taking choices that are not choices that they would take if they had the freedom of choice.
You know, I never thought we'd be talking about AT&T and chickenization. that is a revelation. I had no idea.
And you know what? Yeah, tech workers built all that technology.
Absolutely.
That lets them chickenize.
And
them.
I think I'm hearing a lot of, like, some of the mental health issues. This is arising in the hacker community. It's been ongoing. We're looking at a lot of these issues a lot more and recognizing and wanting to look at sources of this stuff. But I think also it's what it's doing is weaponizing a lot of the skill. And I got that as a takeaway from this particular story, because it's basically taking something that hackers might share and say, like, okay, this is how that works. This is how you do this thing. And it's neat because you're subverting this or you're adjusting that. It's not supposed to do that. Those attitudes disappear when you're obligated to keep to your 50-page NDAs or some felony that the government's going to come back at you for disclosing what you actually do. So we end up having people doing all of this stuff. They can't actually talk about what they do, and you see that in their resumes, like or even job postings. Like everything is so vague because no one really wants to disclose the actual kind of work they're doing. And I just look at this and I think of this huge push to like hire the hackers and like how we can maybe, you know, it was almost a rebrand, maybe. I don't know. I don't want to say that, but it's like 10 or 15 years ago, we get like a push to like, well, this is how we make, you know, big companies secure, is that we have all these different talent pools to use as, you know, exploit their understanding of all this sort of newfangled stuff. But yet it's just to set them out to the playground, as your analogy said, for the bullies. In this sense, a boss or a sort of autonomous entity in a corporation wielding so much control over, again, the only game in town. So there's just so much there that I really brought away, and I thank you for your insight on some of that stuff.
Thank you.
Corey, a couple of chilling things from the book. We're speaking with Corey Doctorow, author of the forthcoming book, Attack Surface. There is on the subject of the corporate landscape as far as employment. At one point, Masha gets a visit from her corporate representatives, I guess, a security force. They do this really invasive search of her apartment, where she can't even leave the room, and they're going through all her personal effects. That was a nightmare. And it was all in her contract that she had to abide by that, and there was nothing she could do to get out of it without incurring substantial penalties. That's still fantasy, right? Or is this based on something real?
Well, I think that like there are lots of people who work in industries where that is the rule, but they tend not to work in white collar industries. So, you know, if you're crew on a cruise ship, that's the regime you labor under, right? If you're a contractor in a forward operations base, that might be the regime that you labor under, right? And digitally, it's becoming far more common. You know, the growth of workplaces that expect you, even before the pandemic, that expect you to be on call 24/7, mm-hmm. that issue you a laptop and a phone like they're doing you a big favor, and then, you know, put man in the middle certificates, intermediate certificates that let them intercept your encrypted traffic on that device, add spyware, add bossware to that device to do the digital equivalent of it, right? Today, with the lockdown, there's been a boom in bossware, which is software that remotely operates the camera and the microphone, takes screenshots, plunders your hard drive. They say, well, you know, just don't use your work device for this. But it's not your work device at that point. It's this thing you're tethered to all day long, and that is in your home, which you have turned into a rent-free branch office for your boss.
Now, the other chilling thing that really resonated with me, and it gave me a legitimate nightmare too, by the way, this is when the autonomous cars turn against people. Basically, they're programmed by the authorities to mow down demonstrators.
Yeah.
I mean, your mind, did you worry about giving people ideas?
This is my response to the trolley problem, right? So that I'm sure you're familiar with it. Like every idiot who thinks they're smart about AI says, well, what about the trolley problem? What if your Mercedes has to decide whether to kill the millionaire behind the wheel or the six kids crossing the road? Maybe it decides to kill you and maybe it decides to kill them or whatever, right? The problem with this whole conception is it starts from the prospect that we're going to have autonomous vehicles that will periodically decide to kill their drivers, and that this will somehow be stable. And the only way this can possibly be a stable situation is if it's illegal to modify your car, because the circumstances under which I want my car to kill me is never, right? That is the rule I want for my car, never kill me. And so if you design a car that is runs programs that the person who is trapped inside the car can't override, then anyone who can figure out how to take control of that part of the car that runs programs that the person in the car can't override can do terrible things to that person. It's such like an obviously terrible idea. I mean, we talk about backdoors and switches being a bad idea. You know, having cars that have like a ring minus zero, right? Having essentially robots, you know, 6,000-pound robots that you trap your wet, squishy body inside of to travel at 100 miles an hour down the highway, that is also like pre-rootkitted, and anyone who can like seize control of it, you know, what a, like the closest analogy, you probably saw Pentest Partners just release this report that there's this bondage toy where you lock your sub's genitals in this cage, and the cage is made out of hardened steel, and it needs an angle grinder to remove it, and the only person who can open it is you with the app, and it's for like, you know, BDSM play, and they just didn't bother to secure it, so like anyone could just hack into it and lock it forever, right? And wow. And you know, that's the only thing I can think of that is in the same range of stupid as designing a car that is deliberately designed so that the driver can't override the software. And so as soon as I wanted to dramatize that, I wrote something else for Deakin University in Australia called Car Wars that was just a series of vignettes about this. And I knew I wanted to put it in the book. Voltaire, I think you had a question.
Go ahead.
Or an intervention.
We're down to our last 2 minutes,
when you're discussing busware and chickenization, especially like chickenization seems to happen to stereotypically blue-collar workers, and busware you see even with white-collar workers. So I think that it's not just a problem of like monopsony when it comes to employers. It's also a question of labor laws and lack of unionization. I think that's why it's encouraging we see organizations like Tech Workers Coalition. And here in New York, we have DSA, Tech Action Working Group. And then you mentioned earlier the 20,000 workers showing Google walkout. And that was able to cancel their AI for the Defense Department initiative. I think that's a really important reform, too, not just monopoly power, but also labor law.
Yeah. 100%. And, you know, there's a crappy technology adoption curve. If you want to know what technology blue-collar workers are going to be subjected to in 5 years, look what we're doing to students. If you want to know what students are going to be subjected to in 5 years, look what we're doing to prisoners. And if you want to know what white-collar workers are going to be doing in 5 years, look what we're doing to blue-collar workers. That's the gradient that our bad technology ascends.
We have been talking with Cory Doctorow, author of the forthcoming book Attack Surface, which will be – when is it officially coming out, Cory?
October the 13th.
All right. That's right around the corner. You can get your autographed book plate copy from WBAI by calling 516-620-3602 if there are any left. We only have a dozen. And pledging $50 or becoming a BAI buddy, go to give2wbai.org if you'd rather do it that way. Corey, any links or sites or things you want to give out? Go right ahead.
Totally. If you go to pluralistic.net, that's my daily writing on the web, and one of the things you'll find in every day's edition this week is a link to the upcoming Attack Surface virtual tour, 8 nights in 8 bookstores, including at the Strand with guests from across all the different disciplines that the book touches on. Every one of those tickets to those events comes with a signed book. So if you can't get one of the copies that Tor was kind enough to donate to WBAI, you can get one from one of these tour stops. They're all going to be super dope. We're talking about intersectionality, surveillance, and race. We're talking about science fiction. We're talking about tech. We're talking about all the good stuff.
Corey, it has been a delight talking to you. We could talk to you all night long. Thanks for everything you do. Thanks for that great keynote you gave at the HOPE conference this summer, one of 9 keynotes that we had. And we look forward to seeing what you come up with next. But I hope lots of people read this book. It really is an incredible piece. And,
thank you.
Best of luck in everything you do.
Thanks, guys. Everyone wear a mask.
Yes, and stay tuned for the debate and for our special programs. Good night.
I can see clearly now the rain is gone. See all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. It's gonna be a bright, 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 sunshiny day. It's gonna be a bright, 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 sunshiny day. I think I can make it now.
WBAI's LSB, the local station board, is Wednesday, October 14th at 7 p.m. Because of coronavirus precautions and restrictions, the meeting will be a remote access meeting. It will be accessible to the public. It will include an opportunity for public comment. At the meeting, the local station board may discuss WBAI's potential for partnerships and relationships with other groups and entities. The WBAI LSB is the Pacifica Foundation board, which advises local management and operations. Again, that's Wednesday, October 14th at 7 p.m. The meeting is held through the Zoom remote meeting service. It can be accessed by calling 929-205-6099. These are a lot of numbers, but if you have a pencil, the telephone number to call is 929-205-6099, meeting ID 922-457-2995. A link to instructions, including for listening over the web and how to submit written comments, will be available on WBAI's main webpage. That's at WBAI.org. Again, WBAI's local station board meeting is on Wednesday, October 14th at 7 p.m. Go to our website, WBAI.org, and see how to sign in. And the LSB always says, do you have to contribute to WBAI to access the meeting? No, but why not? This is listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
A station dedicated to and sponsored by its listeners. From 1960 to present day, WBAI has been promoting an innovative perspective of news, public affairs, music, arts, health, and science. In order to provide a truly unique voice to New York City, WBAI receives its financial assistance from listeners like you. To help WBAI continue this tradition, you can become a BAI buddy by giving a generous monthly donation of as little as $10. It's a safe, secure, and simple way to support your local station. To become a BAI buddy, go to give2wbai.org. That's give, the number 2, wbai.org.
Activist Sharon Salam speaks out for WBAI.
We should be moving forward, collecting the funds that we need to make sure that our station is whole and that it can do its job as it has done for me in the past. When all of this stuff happened to me many, many years ago in 1989, I didn't get very many opportunities to speak out in regards to the wrong that was done to my son and the other boys in the Central Park jogger case, as it was called at that time. Very few people stepped up. Yes, Like It Is was there. WBAI was there. And a few others. Majority of those stations that let people like myself speak and tell them what was going on the other side, those stations are gone. If we lose WBAI, where do we go to get our words out? Where do we go if you've been arrested unjustly? Where do you go if someone's taken your children unfairly? Where do you go to seek justice? We must keep this station alive. Alive. WBAI.
No justice.
This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul. You know, sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree, with a joy that's hard to hide. And then sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry. And then you're bound to see my other side. But that's one thing I never mean to do, 'cause I love you.
Good evening. This is Gloria J. Brown Marshall in a special edition of Law of the Land, the pre-vice presidential debate special edition. This is a program sponsored by WBAI 99.5 FM in conjunction with our sister station WPFW in Washington, D.C., all in service to you, our listeners. This vice presidential debate will pit two attorneys against each other. It will be historic in many ways beyond their occupations. One, a U.S. senator, female, the other, a vice presidential, I guess, supporter of Donald Trump in many, many ways, but also the chief czar of the Coronavirus Committee Task Force. He's also the former governor of Indiana. Mike Pence, 61, Harris, 55, are people who will be of even greater importance because of the ages of the men on the ticket. Donald Trump, 74, and Joe Biden, 77. We need to hear from you, our listeners. Give us a call, 212-209-2877. Our pre-debate show will end at 9 o'clock. As you see, if you're watching on television or you're listening now, we'll give you a blow-by-blow detailed commentary afterwards. We want you to be able to stay involved, be informed, be empowered. This pre-vice presidential debate, this special edition, was created just for you leading up to the debate, which will have a national broadcast across the entire country from all of our Pacifica sister and brother stations. So many issues, the economy, protests. Remember, the streets are still filled with protesters standing up for the slain George Floyd, whose life was taken by an officer, a white officer, on May 25th. An officer we find today has been able to post a $1 million bail to get out of jail. $1 million. There are enough people who actually believe in this man's innocence or his justification to post his bail. These issues are before us in this election. Breonna Taylor and the justice she did not receive from the bullets that entered her apartment as she slept on March 13th in her bed, and others dying at the hands of police. And at the same time, we have Trump and Pence on this law and order ticket. The coronavirus cases have increased. There are many, many people still suffering from unemployment. And of course, if they lose their jobs, in many situations, they've lost their health care. All of these issues are on the table at this time. 212-209-2877. We also need to realize that the Senate could be flipped this time around as well. All of those Senate seats, the 51 necessary to ascension of Amy Coney Barrett, who is going to walk in the footsteps of the late Antonin Scalia and has, as an person we know in her private life, sworn to demolish a woman's right to choose. We also know that there are those who are being detained right now, another report out, their children stripped from them at the border of Mexico. All of these issues are before us and so many more. As we struggle with this coronavirus, we know that people are gathering right now in Salt Lake City, Utah, preparing for this debate between Kamala Harris and Mike